thank you once again, Ilham, for fascinating insight into the workings of the Research Council and the policy framework. Our next speaker is, I'll stick with this microphone, our next speaker is Marcus Buckhorn from the Australian National University. Marcus is Director of ICT Environments, and we will be presenting on a report that came out earlier this year looking at sustainability issues for Australian research data. Over to you, Marcus.
Thank you, Keith. I have to apologise. This is actually a three-hour talk, and I was horrified when Keith told me I had 20 minutes. So I'm going to talk very fast, but I'm also going to gloss over a few things. This talk is based on a survey we carried out the second half of last year, looking at a range of research communities around Australia, surveying particularly the ones that had large-scale data problems. I don't mean large-scale data as in lots of data. It was more the problems were complex or long-lived. So for this audience, I don't need to explain. It's not about just the publications. It's about the scholarly input, the raw data, the semi-reduced data, derived, calculated data, simulations, and so on, which may lead to publications, but it's about that primary input. And in that context, research data has a very different lifestyle to your typical publication cycles. It has many more problems associated with it. It has a much richer lifestyle that it goes through. There's a reusability component that's far richer in that space. And because it comes from so many different sources, the issues just pile up exponentially. There's a fair bit of conversation now at the moment around the e-research infrastructure that we're building nationally and whether e-research solves all of our problems. And while it's certainly necessary, it's not a sufficient solution for some of the things we need in this space, which I'll come back to. Now, because I come from a technology background, people expect to see technical diagrams. So, you know, I could talk at length about building repositories, architecting repositories into federations, linking them against compute services, providing single points of view, building services into a data commons that we can then present to Evan in his next presentation. Or looking even at the life cycle of data, the processes that we go through when data first gets created at some point, goes through possibly a storage point, gets reused, and then possibly reacquired to go back through that cycle again. But I'm not going to cover any of that. I could also go into a whole bunch of the different application areas and try and tease out some of the common requirements. The groups we talked with weren't just about very large-scale data. Yes, we had groups who were going to generate petabytes, 1,000 gigabytes of data a day, day after day, year after year. But we also talked with groups who had a data set that fits on your memory stick, and it changed by a few characters here and there once every few weeks. It was more the value of the data. What was the life around that data that we had to look at? There is data that is spatially driven, there is data that is time-driven, there is data that is spatially and time-based driven. You get into some of the archaeological data sets and so on. Or then you look at other things like in the bioinformatics community, very simple data sets, large volumes of them. And yet they can continually improve their instruments and collect new data sets and replace the old stuff. And in some cases, they don't even do reasonable record management where, for example, a gene sequence might be published one day. It gets stored in the three national global databases for gene sequences. The next researcher that comes along with the same sequence can overwrite that record. So if you're doing an analysis last week and you do the analysis again today, you might get a different result. This seems to be something that's just completely glossed over in that discipline, but people seem to cope. You look at something like astronomy, where the data is not only voluminous and complex, but also has to be kept forever. Astronomy is one of those one-shot sciences. Every observation, in theory, has to be kept forever. Pragmatically, what happens in practice might be completely different. You know, I've seen many astronomers, used to be one, keeping their data on tapes under their desk. Yes, it is preserved, but how well? There's also examples in social sciences where we're not just dealing with quantitative data, but also with qualitative data, which gets even more complicated. How do you preserve that? How do you store it? How do you make it meaningful years or decades down the track? So if you start trying to tease out all of the common issues in that space, you can start to say, okay, there's some common technical issues around the sustainability of the data. How do you cope with data formats? Once you start writing data to disk or to some storage device, you have a particular format to that data. Can you recover that format 10 or 20 years down the track? In some cases, that data format is specific to an application. Do you then start preserving the applications? If you preserve the applications, you're starting to talk about preserving the operating systems they ran in. And I know, especially in the library areas, there are certainly some old computers out the back running very old operating systems because that one application hasn't been migrated. That is not a sustainable model either. We also have the same issues with metadata, describing the data itself. There are just so many different ways that we have to consider, or we have to describe the data. So not just about the actual scientific metadata, but also the way we preserve it, the provenance, how it's been curated, how it has been changed over time. And it's wonderful if you find a discipline where there's a global standard for that metadata. More often than not, especially in the science disciplines, you have either zero schemas as a standard, or you have five or more. And you've got to pick one. Okay, so technical problems can be dealt with that way, And then we have that little subtle issue around the rights. And we've had the term intellectual property brought up quite a few times. It's actually more complicated than that because there are other sensitivities. There are human and cultural sensitivities around data as well that we need to deal with. We need to deal with the concept of the ownership of the data. Yes, if a researcher collects the data and the institution supports that researcher, there's an ownership concept there, that the institution has a role. But if it's a recording, say, in linguistics of a performance out in the field, the ownership resides with the performers, who then go on and die. So some of the agreements around the reuse of that data have to be, you know, thought of very much in the longer term. So we do have now some data collections on our systems that were sourced from original analog recordings 50 years ago. Back then, an agreement was made between the performer and the recorder to say, yes, you can keep that data and you can share it with your colleagues. You know, not too much, but within some constraint. They didn't think about the internet, the web, remote access, global collaborations, and so on. So the policies that, you know, that human framework is much richer and more complex today than it was 50 years ago. Okay, so in general, I'm hoping I'm speaking to the converted here anyway. Why do we want to do this? We have plenty of examples of data being reused and reanalyzed, both in the expected kind of way, new people verifying or adding to data sets, and occasionally some unexpected reuse. And I can come back to some examples later on. We can also solve some good problems. We are currently wasting money recollecting data. We're wasting people's time reanalyzing that recollected data. If the data has been collected well, is managed well, we can use it once and reuse it ever more. We are losing irretrievable data. In the ecology world, in anything to do with people, anything to do with the environment, in astronomy and other places, you know, you do have that snapshot in time concept, and you can't go back and recover that data. And we do have to admit that occasionally some of our colleagues may not be very precise with their interpretations of the data. So the ability to go back, for other groups to go back and verify research, is very important. It's fundamental to the scientific method. There are some key requirement areas. We build collective data sets that are input to the cultural heritage of the world. They are important to national policy developments. Think about healthcare. Think about the environment. Think about education. And the important thing is that, yes, we've collected the data, but it's not, that's not the valuable part. The valuable part is in making it accessible. So, where is this reuse happening? It's happening in quite a few disciplines. There are some great examples. There are some horror stories as well of data reuse not working very well. We have some interesting things that came out of the survey in terms of, yes, it's great to have a policy that data has to be kept forever, but it's not the only policy we work under. We also work under other policy frameworks where data has to be gotten rid of proactively. One of the nicest examples, if nice is the right term, for example, in New South Wales, every hospital has its own ethics committee. And if you're dealing with a medical survey of a particularly rare condition, every single data point might only occur in one hospital once every year. And then you've got to associate with that one data point a policy framework for that hospital. And so, you know, coordination of some of these policy frameworks is quite important. We are starting to see a change in culture developing now, and it seems to be something about the newer generation. Maybe it's the Gen Y researchers now starting to come through, where people are starting to become more aware of the value of this data becoming accessible outside of their project or even outside of their domain. The internet has allowed us the capability to discover that people have data and that the data can be accessible. And that excites quite a few of the, again, the younger researchers. We are at a point now where we can start to build frameworks and technologies around managing the data going forward. but we have a real issue going back with existing data. If you want to mention a point that makes Evan's skin crawl, talk about digitization. It's very hard to go back in time. But if you have a priority to go back to pick up particular things, then we can start to look at that. And we are starting to see our users express new fears on top of the old fears they had before. And I'll come back to that in a moment. All right, so let's do a SWOT of what the government and the funders can do in this space. Well, they control the dollars. They control the policy. They even provide some of the data sources that are key. And a virtual chocolate bar for everybody who gets all the acronyms right. But there's a whole bunch of weaknesses in this world as well. Currently, we have a very nice policy, as Ellen articulated for the ARC. It politely suggests that publicly funded data should be appropriately, I don't want to use the word publicly, accessible down the track. Now, the problem is that policy has no teeth. There is no way of saying, well, you didn't actually fulfill your requirements of that last grant for your data management plan in the most effective way. Shall we not fund you for the next X grant applications until you get it right? I think there'd be a bit of an uproar if we tried that one on. Even if there were some teeth, we don't have the infrastructure yet. Yes, I can have a data management plan that says I will lodge my research data set in the most wonderful repository out there. Oh, there isn't one. Okay, how are we going to get there? And even when we do make that effort and everything is there, we don't have the mechanisms today to recognise that effort. It is an additional cost for the researchers to carry this out. And in general, they get recognised for their publications. They don't get recognised for the data they've collected. So we do get recognition for the publications that come out of a collection, but it doesn't go back to the original collecting effort. And, of course, the typical one, which NCRIS has picked up on, is that funding is project-oriented. It's designed for a 1, 2, 3-year cycle, and then at the end of it we're telling people, oh, and your data has to be accessible for 50 years. There's a fundamental collision there. There are opportunities in that sector to build some more effective policies and, more importantly, coordinated policies. Like I said, we deal with federal, state, territory, local, and institutional policy frameworks. Sometimes they completely and utterly collide. We now have the ability, if all the money lines up right, to build a coordinated and a sustainable infrastructure, to build a coordinated skill set in the community, and I'll come back to that in a moment. And we basically can start to build that research effectiveness. But, as I mentioned before, what's happening today is we're losing that irretrievable data, we are wasting dollars, we have insufficient data for some of our key inputs, for policy in particular, and we are competing in a global world. We are losing researchers who are going to places where things are done better. Now, that's not to say that the model that the UK, the US, and some of the Asian countries have developed is the best model, but there is that awareness and that cultural change. Take it down a layer from those government agencies, and we start getting into the organisations, institutions, universities, government agencies, and so on. Ultimately, they employ the staff that collect the data. I'm waiting for the day when somebody is going to put on the selection criteria, must not come with data, because it is too hard or too expensive to take somebody on because they come with baggage, if you like. The universities or other organisations manage the funds that those staff acquire over time through their research offices and so on. So there's this concept of a certain management obligation. Most of the research funding that happens in Australia doesn't come directly from, say, the research councils. It comes through the salaries that are paid from the universities. They support and guide and make decisions on research directions in their institutions. There's a strong view that universities or other institutions own the data. It is not the people collecting the data. Most researchers don't feel comfortable with that point of view, and when they change institutions, they tend to want to take the data with them. We need to deal with that. There's that long-term support issue, and there's that rather interesting legal point as well. Under the Records Act, information collected as part of the business of an organisation is a record that has to be preserved under the appropriate rules, and there are disposal authorities for some of those records. As far as I can tell, with maybe one exception, research and education are not part of the business of a university. Hang on a minute. Our records office would scream if we tried to get them to take care of our research data, but it's an interesting policy clash there. And as Ian made the point before, there are interesting pressures where we both get the value out of the data and the responsibility, and we're trying to sort of say, well, we want to hand it over, but at the same time, we're trying to get more money out of that data. Now, whether that applies to 100% of our data or not, I don't, that's debatable. And culturally, we have these poor users down the bottom of the stack who are actually quite human at the end of the day, and they have a whole bunch of fears. Some of those fears are quite well-founded, some of them are less so. We do have researchers who, once they've collected the data, will hang on to it and publish and publish and publish and publish from that one data set, and they won't share it. In some cases, they collect the data and don't publish for a long time, and 10 years later they say, well, I'm still analysing it, I haven't got my publication sorted. So some of the big data sources now, the big instruments and so on, have a policy that says, right, the PI has a license to the data for 18 months, and then it becomes public. Get your papers out, or it's not your data anymore, or not your license anymore. Some academics, and interestingly, it seems to be a later stage academics, are quite nervous about the some of the data that they've used, if there are errors in that data. Oops, suddenly my last five papers are invalid. There are inappropriate leaks to deal with, and like I said before, there's that sensitivity from where the data came from. Some of the medical data, drug users that are self-identifying, you're dealing with very sensitive personal data in that space. Fishermen was another great example. They are very sensitive about the data they provide to some of the survey in the marine sciences because it is very much their livelihood. There's a range of other fears, then I'll come back later, but the last one's an important one. The unknown custodian, who takes care of my data? How can that facility over there do as good a job as my PhD student? Which says something about the usefulness of our PhD students for doing PhDs. We have to recognise, and literally I mean that in the recognition of the certification sense, what's the effort, what's the outcome for an academic to do this? We can't back that recognition up at this stage. We need to have a place that is recognised for the deposit of that data. So that starts getting you thinking about certification of repositories. You know, how good and how sustainable is that repository? And that's only half the story. Then how do you certify the process for that deposit of that data? You know, can we have a really good effort into a really bad repository or vice versa? And then who carries out that recognition process or that certification process? Who watches the watches is a problem. We have a big skills problem, and I'm glad it came up a couple of times in the previous presentations. One of the interesting things that we've just picked up recently is this growing need we have for these translator roles. People who can speak geek to the tech people and science to the scientists. And it's quite a difficult skill to acquire. And we don't have a lot of people with that skill, but those people tend to be quite invaluable. And interestingly, and part of this survey, and since then I've been looking a bit more carefully at this, most of the people who've developed good translator skills don't come from the IT side. They tend to come from the disciplines. And interestingly, you know, there seems to be a larger proportion that come from the humanities and social sciences than they do from, say, the physical sciences. So we're not going to get, it doesn't appear we can get our computer science graduates to become excellent translators. There are exceptions, but predominantly what we've seen today is they come from the disciplines. And these are people who've given up academic careers in general. That tells you something about how do we create more of these kinds of people. I don't know what it tells us, but it tells us something. Valuation, how do you value the data to keep? You know, we're getting to the point where, storage is getting cheaper and cheaper, it's easier and easier to store stuff, tapes and discs are mass-produced all the time. Maybe we are getting to the point where we could keep everything. Nobody wants to have that problem of making a decision about what data to keep and what to get rid of. But somebody pointed out the other day that our ability to generate data is going up at a particular slope, and our ability to build disk drives and tape drives is going up at a slightly lower slope. So there's a crossover coming in a few years' time where, like peak oil, we're going to have a tipping point and we're going to go back to this pragmatic problem of what do we actually keep. Ellum's already actually addressed this neatly in his talk as well. You know, how do we follow the dollars? How do we look at the sustainability of this? If we have the same bucket of money that we have today, do we expect our academics to do more with the same amount of money, or do we just give it to fewer academics to do more with the same bucket of money? And I was grateful to see the Productivity Commission saying, oh, yes, let's just have another new funding stream. Great, bring it on. Implementation is going to be an interesting problem. And Evan's already talked about the ANZ efforts, and actually that goes into far more detail. But ideally, we're trying to get the users out of being involved in data management as far as possible. We can scale on the technologies, we can scale on the support, But what we want to try and do is get the users to do the very simplest things to make their data manageable, archivable, curatable. They'll have responsibilities ongoing, but we've got to make those responsibilities as easy as possible to implement. So we have to enable our users to lodge these things themselves. We need to deal with those fears that our users have expressed. That's culture change. Some of it is education. Some of it is trust development. And we do need the users to still be involved with some of the domain specifics. Sorry, just rushing through this because I know Keith is timing me out. So we've already actually had covered that the agencies are thinking about this across all of the layers of government now. We are seeing at the federal and even the state level a lot of interest in what the problems are in this space. I was very surprised to see the Productivity Commission actually looking into this as deeply as they did. But they brought another whole perspective to this, and the ARC input to the Productivity Commission was interesting as well. The NCRIS program provides us, hopefully, with the Australian National Data Service that will start to give us a foundation. There are a huge number of gaps. When you actually do a mapping exercise of all of the activities required to do this right, there are still a large number of gaps. But at least it's a starting point that we can start to build on and start to understand some of the scaling issues we have. Here's hoping. And there I'll stop. Thank you.